From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Donovan joins us with his guitar to talk about his life and music. The Scottish songwriter and musician gave us several hippie anthems of the 60s like Catch the Wind, Mellow Yellow, Wear Your Love Like Heaven, and Sunshine Superman. He has his first new CD in 8 years called Beat Cafe. Also, we meet Kristen Gore, the second oldest daughter of Al and Tipper Gore, has been a comedy writer for shows such as Futurama and Saturday Night Live. Now she has her first novel, Sammy's Hill, about Washington, D.C. from the perspective of a young Capitol Hill staffer who's trying to balance her work with her personal life. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. People on the Gulf Coast are bracing for the arrival of Hurricane Ivan, which is currently raging toward Cuba with winds of 160 miles per hour. The Category 5 storm is already blamed for at least 68 deaths across the Caribbean. More than 1 million people have been evacuated from the tobacco-growing region of western Cuba, where the hurricane is expected to hit hardest. President Bush campaigned in Michigan today, a state he lost in 2000, and where polls show him trailing John Kerry by a small margin. NPR's Don Gagne reports from Battle Creek, Michigan.
The president toured the west side of the state, appearing before crowds who got tickets through the local Republican Party. Polls show the economy to be the number one issue in Michigan. The state has lost nearly 250,000 jobs since Mr. Bush took office. He acknowledged the worries people have here, but said the situation is improving, that the jobless rate is falling, and he gave credit to tax cuts passed over the past 3 years. The president did not mention the assault weapons ban, which has now expired. Michigan residents support the ban. The president says he does as well, but he's been criticized for not doing anything to push the Republican-controlled Congress to extend the ban. Don Gagne, NPR News in Battle Creek, Michigan.
Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry accused the president today of a failure of leadership for not actively supporting the extension of the assault weapons ban. He said the president favored powerful friends in the gun lobby over police officers and families.
Today, George Bush chose to make the job of terrorists easier and make the job of America's police officers harder, and that's just plain wrong.
Senator John Kerry. The terrorism case of Zacharias Moussaoui has taken yet another legal twist. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
The basic issue in the Moussaoui case is whether a defendant can face the death penalty if his lawyers cannot question witnesses who might exonerate him. The witnesses here are three top al-Qaeda operatives now in U.S. custody abroad. According to an appeals court in Richmond, the witnesses have told U.S. interrogators Moussaoui was not involved in the September 11th attacks. But the court still ruled that Moussaoui should stand trial on the September 11th charges without his lawyers being able to question the witnesses. The court said the jury should see a summary of the witnesses' evidence. That ruling was based on the government's representation that prosecutors had no part in interrogating the witnesses. But in May, the government secretly told the court that members of the prosecution team had in fact submitted questions to the witnesses. And so now the court has revised its ruling to allow the defense to do the same. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow gained a point to close at 10,314 in active trading. The Nasdaq was up 16 to 1910. This is NPR News. One day after filing for bankruptcy protection, lawyers for Arlington, Virginia-based U.S. Airways were back in court today. The nation's seventh-largest airline is seeking protection from its creditors for the second time in as many years. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
The attorney representing U.S. Airways told a bankruptcy court judge in Virginia that management at the troubled airline, quote, isn't here to preside over a liquidation. But such confident talk does not appear to be reassuring many in the analyst community. Richard Abalafia is with the Thiel Group.
The odds are somewhat against them emerging from this. And very simply, there's just no way their current cost structure is competitive.
U.S. Airways blames its second bankruptcy filing just 18 months after emerging from its previous restructuring on dwindling levels of cash and the lack of an agreement on further cost-cutting with its unions. Standard & Poor's has downgraded U.S. Airways' credit rating to D, or default status. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
The Bush administration is expected to ask Congress to shift billions of dollars from Iraqi reconstruction projects to security. State Department officials told congressional staffers today that the administration wants to take about $3.5 billion earmarked for water, sewer, and electricity projects and use it to pay for more security forces and police. The administration also wants to channel part of the money into increasing Iraq's oil production and into job creation and debt relief. Officials say the change in priorities represents the administration's belief that Iraqi reconstruction won't be able to go forward until the security situation is more stable. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Fleischman Hillard International Communications and its worldwide network of employees. Fleischman Hillard, delivering strategic public relations and public affairs programs that make a difference.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Donovan, wrote several folk rock hippie anthems of the 60s, like Catch the Wind, Sunshine Superman, Mellow Yellow, Wear Your Love Like Heaven, and The Hurdy-Gurdy Man. Although that description may make him sound dated, the fact is you can hear the influence of his singing on many performers today, including Belle and Sebastian. Donovan, who wrote I Love My Shirt, had his song Mellow Yellow used in a Gap campaign about 4 years ago. When he first started recording, he was sometimes called Britain's answer to Bob Dylan. After experiencing fame, in the 70s he retreated to a more secluded life, but continued to record every few years. Now he has his first new CD in 8 years. It's called Beat Cafe. Let's start with the title track. Donovan, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Donovan, you were born in Scotland, and at about the age of 10, your family moved to London. How old were you when you actually started to perform?
Well, my father tells me, in Glasgow, where I spent the first 10 years of my life, that at the age of 5, I was at a Robert Burns evening, and a blind pianist played There Was an Old Lady Who Swallowed a Fly, the Burl Ives single, and I performed it, and I memorized every line. So it seems I began performing at 5 or 6.
And when you got to England, did you start playing with bands then? Like, what was your first incarnation on stage?
When I arrived in England at the age of 10, I was just reaching my adolescence, and 2 years later, very quickly, I started listening to Everly Brothers and Buddy Holly. I was a bit too young for Elvis, actually. And then when I went to college, about 15, I started listening to Woody Guthrie and Jack Elliott and Pete Seeger and Joan Baez, and I was fully fired to adopt all the folk songs I could. And then I hitchhiked away from home. I left the college disillusioned. So I joined Bohemia. And my first performances, Terry, were on beaches and on street corners, busking. And so I traveled. But very soon, and very quickly, I was discovered and I was on television.
Yeah, you were on the program Ready, Steady, Go, which was kind of, I guess, similar to like Shindig and Hullabaloo in the States. It was a show that featured, you know, hits of the day, and I think there were dancers on it, too.
That's right, Ready, Steady, Go. The weekend begins here, Friday, on one night, overnight. All over Britain, one artist would appear and be known as a household name thereafter, and that was me.
Now, after you did Ready, Steady, Go, you recorded a couple of demo versions, not of your songs, but of other people's songs. You did a demo of a Buffy St. Marie song called Codeine and a song by Tim Hardin called London Town. Why were those demos to show how you could sing? Was that the point of them? To interest a record company?
Well, in actual fact, the recordings you speak of have just been found in my archive, and I call it 64, available on my website, that we discovered these recordings and found that they were made before the television shows.
Oh.
They were made my first appearance in Tin Pan Alley in London, and so these were the first test recordings in a publishing company called Southern Music, now Peer Music. So I walked into a publishing house and recorded 9 what we call demos, and those were the songs that got me the publishing deal. So I recorded these songs just as if they were my repertoire of the day.
Well, why don't we hear one of them? Because these are actually both included on an anthology of your work called Troubadour, the Definitive Collection. So how about we hear Codeine, your version of a Buffy St. Marie song? Sound good?
Oh, Buffy would be wonderful to play right now. She is a marvel, and I loved recording her songs.
Okay, so here's Donovan, his very first recording. It's called Codeine, written by Buffy St. Marie.
And my belly is craving, I got shaking in my head. I feel like I'm dying, and I wish I were dead. If I live till tomorrow, it's gonna be a long time. For I'll reel and I'll fall and rise on codeine. And it's real, and it's real one more time. When I was a young man, I learned not to care. While whiskey in front of it, I often did swear. My mother and father said whiskey's a curse, but the fate of their baby is many times worse. And it's real, and it's a real one more time.
That's Donovan, recorded in 1964, a demo recording, his version of a song by Buffy St. Marie. So you were pretty kind of folk-oriented at the very start. How did that start to change?
Well, you can hear in my guitar playing that I'm reaching beyond the folk scene. Although I'd begun performing as a folk singer, I was biting into the guitar with my guitar pick, and I didn't realize at first, but what I was trying to do was come up with a kind of a Celtic rock, a kind of a fusion where the pop sensibilities and the blues and jazz as well, I could blend into my folk style. At the same time, I was also writing, of course, poetry. An enormous amount of songs started pouring out. And the jazz that I was listening to in college, Miles Davis and Charlie Parker, and essentially Billie Holiday from the jazz world, and the classical music, and the Beatles, and the Rolling Stones, and when Hendrix came along, listening to Jimmy. And the change was not sit down and write Sunshine Superman album, but out of my songs, I met a producer called Mickey Most, and John Cameron was the arranger, and we began to make that album, Sunshine Superman, which was so eclectic and so experimental, and at least a year and a half before Sgt. Pepper.
Well, since you've just mentioned Sunshine Superman, why don't we hear it? And this is your recording from 1966.
Sunshine came softly through my window today. Could have tripped out easy, but I changed my way. It'll take time, I know it, but in a while you're gonna be mine, I know it. We'll do it in style, 'cause I made my mind up. You're going to be mine, I'll tell you right now. And I'm tricking a book, and I'll be better.
That's Donovan, recorded in 1966. I have a very profound question for you, and that is, where did you get your clothes in the 60s when you were on TV and radio and touring all the time?
We used to go down to the vintage, what you call vintage clothes shops, and it was Portobello Road, and Brian Jones, who invented the Rolling Stones, was the first to raid the old velvets and the feathered boas and the, and the corduroy jackets and the clothes from a bygone age. But all of us came out of art school, so we were very into the image. And so the Who would dress up in pop art with Targets and Union Jacks. They'd get their clothes made out of flags. Because what the art students are wearing this year, probably a lot of young people will be wearing next year.
My guest is Donovan. He has his first new CD in 8 years. It's called Beat Cafe. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Donovan. He has a new CD called Beat Cafe. His hits of the 60s include Catch the Wind, Sunshine Superman, and Wear Your Love Like Heaven. Let's hear one of the songs he recorded in 1966.
I'm just mad about saffron. Saffron's mad about me. Just mad about saffron. She's just mad about me. They call me mellow yellow, quite rightly. They call me mellow yellow, quite rightly. They call me mellow yellow. I'm just mad about 14.
Now, I should apologize in advance for asking you a question you've probably been asked more times than you could care to count. Your song Mellow Yellow, which was a big hit in 1966, a lot of people assumed that that was about getting high by smoking banana peels. What was the song about?
You know, it was about being mellow. The color saffron is the color of the Buddhist robe. The color saffron. But the name saffron was a girl as well. There's multiple meanings in many songs. But being mellow and laid back is very much a jazz phrase. It you know, be cool, man. You know, don't be so hassle. Just lay back. Could be mellow. But the reference to smoking bananas completely shocked us all at the time. Wonder where anybody got that idea. You can't get high smoking banana peels.
I guess it's then, the line electric banana.
Well, the smoking of the peels, I didn't realize why that had been so tied with my song until 2 or 3 years ago. I was in Cleveland in the Rock and Roll Museum, and I was sitting next to Country Joe McDonald, and we started talking. And Joe said to me, "Hey, man, by the way, it was me." I said, "What do you mean it was you?" "Mellow Yellow, man. And the, you know, the bananas, smoking bananas." I said, "Joe, I got a feeling that I'm not going to like what you're going to tell me here." "Tell me." He said, "Well, man, in San Francisco, 1966, what we thought was we put the band on the back of the truck and we'd go down to an old yard I know, and it has all these carnival floats that they threw away, and we found this giant banana, and we put it on the truck, we started up the band, we drove down through Haight-Ashbury, playing the music, advertising a gig. But just to make sure the people knew we were coming, we announced to the press that you can get high smoking bananas." And he said, "That would have been the end of it, but that Friday, you released the single, Mellow Yellow."
Uh-huh.
I said, "Joe, thanks, because I've been asked for 35 years. why do you say you can get high smoking bananas? Because I guess millions tried it, Terry.
That's a great story.
Electrical banana is gonna be a sudden craze. They call me Mellow Yellow.
That's Donovan, recorded in 1966. He has a new CD, and it's called Beat Cafe. I'm so glad you told the story behind that. That clears up that clears up a lot of issues. One of the things you have the distinction of is being the first British pop musician to be busted for smoking marijuana. This was in 1966, which was the same year as Mellow Yellow. What were the circumstances?
Victimization by the drug squad in the establishment to try to stop the free flow of ideas coming through the new revolutionary pop groups, Beatles included, the Rolling Stones. They busted me because I think they thought, well, we'll get him first, and then we'll get the Stones and the Beatles, and then we'll go on to the other ones. And that was so. But it was very clear in the press and to all my friends that it was definitely a victimization. I was fined. I wasn't put in jail. And I was given a caution that I was a voice of youth and that I must take responsibility.
The truth is, the following year, in 67, you renounced drugs and urged your fans to do the same. And you had turned to meditation and hoped your fans would do the same. Did that renunciation have anything to do with the judge's sentiments that you should become a better role model? And if not, what changed in your life that made you want to give up drugs?
No, it was nothing to do with being busted. I continued to smoke after I got busted. I've never considered it to be an unhelpful thing, but I don't promote it. And the giving up of drugs in 67 was this. The reason was this. When the Beatles and I realized that millions of young people were thinking that we were promoting it, when it's truly a subjective use, I mean, anything that is harmful, and there's lots, tobacco and alcohol and overeating and, oh God, there's this enormous amount of things that are bad for you. If the millions of young people thought we were promoting it, something was wrong. We had to make a stand. And so we went to the East. We were looking for a reason and the cause of suffering. And it was nothing to do with drugs. In fact, sacred plants, I would prefer to call them. Out of the inner psyche of the human race comes all the disasters and all the problems. So only meditation and the inner journey. Could we go in, we asked ourselves, and find out if the origins of suffering originate within us? And so I don't know what the Beatles said, but I said, stop, try meditation, stop taking the sacred plants. So that's the reason.
You actually went with the Beatles to India to study with the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. You went all together, right?
That's right. When we arrived there, we were also with Mike Love of the Beach Boys, and Mia Farrow came a little later, and Paul Horn, the jazz flautist.
Mm-hmm. Did the fact that it was this kind of big celebrity gathering affect the actual learning? In other words, I don't know, everybody around the world was interested in the fact that you all were doing this. I don't know if there was a lot of press attention or a lot of just kind of tension within the group because you were at such a kind of high point of your careers and were such lightning rods.
Oh, it was absolutely, no, you're quite right. It was absolutely an outrage to our management and and the industry, and the press and the media of the world followed us and camped outside the ashram. It was extraordinary. We had to have the local army sort of get to stop them breaking in through to try and ask us why were we there, and we just said, go away, we're here to meditate. And finally they slowly went away. The celebrity aspect was very high, of course, but we got down to some serious meditation.
Donovan will be back in the second half of the show. He has a new CD called Beat Cafe. It's his first new CD in 8 years. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
On my garden gates, a snail, that's what it is. The lock up on my garden gates, a snail, that's what it is. First there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is. First there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is. Caterpillar sheds its skin to find a butterfly within. Caterpillar sheds its skin to find a butterfly within. First there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is. First there is a mountain, then there is no mountain. Oh, Juanita. Oh, Juanita. Call your name. Or oh, the snow will be a blinding sight to see as it lies on yonder hillside. Lock up on my garden gates, a snail, that's what it is. Lock up on my garden gates, a snail, that's what it is. Caterpillar sheds its skin to find a butterfly within. Caterpillar sheds its skin to find a butterfly within. First there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is. First there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is. First there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is. First there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the Sundance Channel, presenting The Al Franken Show, political commentary, comedy, and interviews, premieres weeknights at 11:30 on Sundance Channel, and from Anchor Books, publishers of the new paperback The Lord is My Shepherd by Harold Kushner, author of When Bad Things Happen to Good People. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Color in sky, Russian blue. Scarlet.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Donovan. Also, Kristen Gore, daughter of Al and Tipper Gore, talks about her new novel, Sammy's Hill. It's about a 26-year-old Senate aide who is dating a rival senator's speechwriter.
Lord, kiss me once more, fill me with song. Allah, kiss me once more, that I may, that I may. Sky Havana Lake, color sky rose carmethine, alizari and crimson. Where your love like heaven.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Donovan. He wrote and performed several hippie folk rock anthems of the 60s, like Wear Your Love Like Heaven, Catch the Wind, Sunshine Superman, and Mellow Yellow. He has his first new CD in 8 years. It's called Beat Cafe. He brought his guitar to the studio, and I asked him to play one of the songs he's famous for.
Thrown like a star in my vast sleep, I opened my eyes to take a peep, to find that I was by the sea, gazing with tranquility. 'Tis then when the hurdy-gurdy man comes singing the songs of love. Then when the hurdy-gurdy man comes singing the songs of love. Hurdy-gurdy, hurdy-gurdy, hurdy-gurdy-gurdy, he sang. Hurdy-gurdy, hurdy-gurdy, hurdy-gurdy-gurdy, he sang. Hurdy-gurdy, hurdy-gurdy, hurdy-gurdy-gurdy, he sang. Histories of ages past, unenlightened, the shadows cast down through all eternity, the crying of humanity. 'Tis then when the hurdy-gurdy man comes singing the songs of love. Then when the hurdy-gurdy man, he comes singing the songs of love. Beatles were hurdy-gurdy men, they come singing your songs of love. I am the hurdy-gurdy man, I come singing your songs of love. Hurdy-gurdy, hurdy-gurdy, hurdy-gurdy-gurdy, he sang. Hurdy-gurdy, hurdy-gurdy, hurdy-gurdy-gurdy, he sang.
Well, thanks for doing that. That's Donovan performing one of his songs from, was it the late 60s?
Yeah, that came from the Hurdy Gurdy Man album in 68.
Good. Where exactly were you, or what? I know you were in India and studying meditation, but when you wrote Hurdy Gurdy Man, was there something very specific that precipitated the song?
Well, I was in India, and I was playing guitar with George Harrison in the ashram in Rishikesh, and I'd been developing some ideas of this song, Hurdy Gurdy Man, and George gave me a dambura, which is the drone instrument in the Indian ensemble. And that's on the Hurdy Gurdy Man song now, because he gave it to me and I took it back to London and recorded it. The ideas in Hurdy Gurdy Man come from an amalgamation of and an absorption of so many ideas from spiritual books, and in particular the Diamond Sutra. And speaking of Celtic mythology also, that the bardic Celtic tradition.
You know, I think that that is your most imitated and caricatured songs. Like when people wanted to do a Donovan impression, and when you're famous, that's what people do. They do impressions of you. That's the song I think that they would often choose because of the shake in your voice on that song.
Well, Hurdy Gurdy Man, to be re-recorded by others, is wonderful because of the lyrical message. But Season of the Witch, another song of mine, seems to have been adopted again and again and again by so many bands because it makes them feel good when they play. And Led Zeppelin used to use my song, Season of the Witch, to warm up every rehearsal before every performance, so Jimmy Page tells me.
Interesting. Do you know why?
It's just two extraordinary chords, A7th and D9th, and it's funny.
Would you just play those chords so we can hear them?
Yeah, I can play them. When we first start playing guitar, when you're a young musician, you get hooked on a phrase or a musical phrase or a set of chords, and this is the set. Now, when you're a young band and you start playing this, then you realize you're still playing it about 2 hours later. Something must be good about these two chords. But it also allows you to play many different things when you're just vamping and jamming on these two chords. Americans also have recorded it. Dr. John has recorded it for that movie Blues Brothers 2. And also the Allman Brothers, I think, did my song The Mountain. But it was Al Cooper and Stephen Stills recorded it as well.
Right.
But it's a spooky song, and it actually spoke about being busted before I was busted. One of those prophetic things.
Oh, no. Must be the season of the witch. Must be the season of the witch. Must be the season of the witch.
That now, was Season of the Witch.
Had you heard those two chords together in other songs, or did you hear something in those two chords that inspired you to put them together?
This chord, the D ninth, I'd heard from Bert Jansch. Now, it's a very important chord in the world of folk blues and jazz because there's many songs that use it by going, here's the D9th. So it's part of the traditions of jazz and blues. There is a house in New Orleans. It's in there. It's also in Hit the Road, Jack. Don't you come back no more, no more, no. It's in many of the blues progressions. And hey. So it actually is a very established emotional chord in many blues, yeah.
Well, Donovan, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Donovan's new CD is called Beat Cafe. Here's how he sounded in 1966. Coming up, Kristen Gore talks about her new novel and about being the daughter of a senator, vice president, and presidential candidate. This is Fresh Air. After being known to the public as the second oldest daughter of Al and Tipper Gore, Kristen Gore is taking on a new public identity, novelist. Her new book, Sammy's Hill, is about a subject she knows well, life on Capitol Hill. The main character, Samantha Sammy Joyce, is a young healthcare analyst for a U.S. senator from Ohio. The novel follows Sammy's political and personal life as she starts dating a rival senator's speechwriter. Kristen Gore was born in 1977. She graduated from Harvard, where she wrote for the Harvard Lampoon. She's also written for the animated TV series Futurama. Let's start with a reading from Sammy's Hill. Sammy has just spent the night with the rival senator's speechwriter, breaking her long-standing policy of never sleeping with anyone on the first date. But she's more worried about having just violated a political rule about dating.
RG had just warned me to be wary of all Bramin staffers. I was now lying naked in bed with one of them, which suggested I'd let my guard down just a tad. Had I just slept with some sort of enemy? Had James Carville and Mary Madeline felt this way after their first night together? Even if they had, they'd clearly managed to make their relationship work, and Aaron and I had the advantage of working for people who were supposedly on the same side. I decided not to dwell anymore on the negatives because I wanted to stay in my pleasantly glowing good mood, and the night really had been fun.
That's Kristen Gore reading from her new novel, Sammy's Hill. Kristen, welcome to Fresh Air. This reading is about your main character and a man she has just slept with for the first time. So tell us about who each of the characters are.
Well, Sammy is the main character in the book, and she is 26 years old. She's new to D.C. from Ohio and has moved there and is working for a senator from her home state, Senator Robert Gary, who she calls R.G. She has been warned by him to stay away from the staff of another senator, Senator Bramin, because they're rivals and sort of Bramin's crew is not to be trusted. She has met Bramin's speechwriter, a man named Aaron, and been very intrigued by him, and despite her boss's warnings, has gone out on a date with him and now has found herself waking up with him the next morning.
So what are some of the hazards that you think face politically involved single people in Washington? It's certainly something you've thought about for this book and must have also thought about in life itself.
Sure. Well, it was fun to explore it in the fictional world because I did grow up in D.C. and knew so many people who worked on Capitol Hill. And it's an interesting place because it has this reputation that I think I understand why people see it as sort of stiff and boring and a place where old people don't get anything done, but that's not really the D.C. I know, and it's also a place where all these young people flock to try to change the world, and it's and they are doing that in with this backdrop of, you know, national power, and there's all this energy and activity all the time that's very exciting, but also, a lot of them are in their 20s and 30s. A lot of them are single, and there's a huge social scene because they're all thrust together. You know, there's no sort of bride and groom seating in the House and Senate office buildings. You're right next to people from different parties, and you end up interacting all the time. And so that leads to all sorts of strange friendships and romances, and I just wanted to explore that a little bit because it's, I think, a unique part of D.C.
Now, I think when you're growing up in a political family, you have to develop a thick skin. You can't survive in the political world without one. Was it ever just emotionally difficult for you, particularly when your father was running for president, to watch him being attacked for everything from his policies to being stiff?
Yeah, sure. You know, I mean, no one wants to hear that about their dad or a loved one, you know, and usually in any other life, you don't often get barraged with, you know, something like that. So, yeah, it can be very tough. But again, you have to just know it comes with the territory. And I know what he's really like. I know how great he is. And that's the only thing that really matters to me. I wish everyone knew him the way I did. But luckily, a lot of people feel the same way, too.
During the era when he was running for president, one of the big things was like, no, Al Gore is too stiff. Did you give him any advice about that?
You know, it's hard because I think people get these, particularly in politics, they get these images grafted onto them and then it just gets perpetuated, you know, kind of takes on a life of its own, whether or not it's accurate mm-hmm. or not mm-hmm. all the time. So that is a lesson I learned, and you just kind of have to go with it. But I, you know, again, he, I think, is I didn't have to give him advice because I don't want my national leaders to be stand-up comics. You know, I want my national leaders to be serious and to know what to do during times of crisis and times of prosperity to bring us forward. You know, I mean, I think that what's important in that world is your ideas and your commitment and the reasons you're in it. And so I never doubted any of those things with my father. And so that other stuff was just kind of silly to me.
Where were you during the recount era? And how do you think you were changed by that experience?
I was home with my parents. I actually took a leave of absence from Futurama, which was the show I was writing on at the time, because I was sort of useless as a comedy writer for just those 36 days. And the show was thankfully very supportive and let me do that. But it was an emotional roller coaster, definitely. And the whole time, even as different things went up and down and back and forth, and there was something new happening every day, I was so sure that all the votes were going to be counted that it was surprising to me that was halted. I hadn't factored that in as a possibility, so I was pretty shocked. But you know, also really proud of my dad's decision to, in such a crazy time when no one knows how to resolve that. I mean, it was really unprecedented. You have to respect the law. I mean, it's dangerous not to. And no matter what you think the court's motivations are, it's the Supreme Court. And I was raised to respect that. And so, you know, I look to him to be a leader in that time, both for me personally and for the country, and he did not disappoint me.
Now, your mother in the 80s and probably early 90s was particularly famous for being co-founder of the Parents Music Resource Council, mm-hmm. which was a group predominantly of mothers who, you know, were concerned that lyrics and popular music had offensive sexual language that would be damaging for their children to hear. So this is a group that talked to Congress, campaigned for stickers on records that would warn of explicit lyrics. What was that period like for you? I mean, kids want to listen to what they want to listen to. They don't really want their parents involved. And I could see how it could have been almost embarrassing to have your mother campaigning for control over exactly the kind of thing the kids want to control themselves.
Right, right. You know, it's funny because I think my sister, who's 4 years older than me, had a little bit of a tougher time with it because she was about 13. But, you know, I was 9 and not quite at the, you know, I was still listening to Nothing Too Racy. I don't think maybe it's different now, but in the 80s, 9-year-olds certainly like music, but they're not into sort of the hard edge stuff. But as I got older, still had to deal with the sort of misrepresentation of a lot of what my mom was trying to do, because people talked about censorship, which it wasn't at all. You know, it was voluntary labels. And so that was difficult because I just felt that the way it was talked about tended to sort of misrepresent it, and then that would get perpetuated. And also, I just knew my mom as someone who loves music and loves creativity and art and in all forms.
Did she try to control what you listened to?
Oh, no. No, she didn't, actually. She was very...
Did you listen to hip-hop that had the kind of lyrics that she wouldn't have liked?
You know, yeah, I think we went through a phase where we learned all the lyrics to Colors, and which was a rap song at the time. I think my sister taught us all the lyrics when we were 9, and so we would kind of recite them in the van just to let her know that we knew what was going on. I think as a lot of people who were criticizing her at the time got older and had kids of their own and realized what was out there, that a lot of them have actually come to her and said, oh, I'm so sorry that I didn't really understand what you were trying to do that then. And now that I have a kid and see everything, I like having these tools. So I think that's gratifying for her. And, you know, it's all been a while ago now.
My guest is Kristen Gore. Her new novel is called Sammy's Hill. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Kristen Gore, daughter of Al and Tipper. She's written her first book, a novel set on Capitol Hill, called Sammy's Hill.
Now, when your father was on Saturday Night Live, you wrote one of the sketches for him, right?
Yes, I did.
How did you get do that?
Well, I in college, I went to Harvard and I wrote for the Lampoon. That's how I sort of got into comedy writing and got the idea to do it as a career. And a lot of my fellow Lampooners after school applied to different shows, and four of them were on Saturday Night Live. And so they asked me to be a guest writer because I had been working in comedy. I was at Futurama and was working on another show at that point with Nathan Lane. And I was in L.A., but I went to New York for the week. And I think they thought, you know, I know my dad better than they do, and I'm in comedy writing, and so why not join the team? And that was really, really fun for me because I think I would have been terrified under other circumstances just because of Saturday Night Live's, you know, reputation and the way that they work there. But the people that I knew from college who I had been writing with before were very welcoming, and I had a really fun time. It was a great week.
So what did you write?
I wrote the introduction, the monologue that went into the Bachelor parody where he ended up you know, handing out roses to potential vice presidential candidates. That was the sketch that I worked on, and it was really, I thought he did a great job with it. It was sort of fun because The Bachelor was, it's sort of now, and I don't know what incarnation it's in now, but at the time it was new and kind of everyone was tuned into it and couldn't believe sort of the new influence of reality television, and particularly that show. And so it was fun to kind of put my dad in that context, and he ended up in one scene in a hot tub with the actor playing Joe Lieberman to sort of drinking champagne, and he was the one that won the rose. So it was fun to be able to get to sort of comment on this Bachelor phenomenon and put my dad in there and mix in politics. I really enjoyed all that whole mixture.
Now, one of the sketches on the show was a parody of the famous Kiss.
Yeah, I did work on that one too.
Did you at the convention? And in this one, like your father playing himself, and I forget which actress playing your mother, Tipper Gore, you know, have that kiss, but it becomes this kind of like mad smooch fest.
It was my mom. My mom did it.
Oh, it was your mom. I did.
Yeah,
I couldn't remember.
Yeah, okay. It was at my mom. It was the very beginning of the show, and it was my actual mom and my actual dad. Yeah, sort of reenacting it, but obviously.
So you co-wrote that?
Yeah, I did. You know, I sort of helped out with that. There was not a lot of dialogue because they were mainly kissing, but there was some.
Was it hard to sell your parents on the idea of doing this?
No, it actually wasn't. I mean, they both love Saturday Night Live and were big fans of the show and are completely, they have great senses of humor and good senses of humor about themselves, too. And they were very game for it. They thought it was hilarious. My dad actually still says when people say, what would you do differently in 2000? He said, I definitely would have kissed Tipper longer.
How involved or emotionally involved are you in the presidential race now?
Well, I am involved to the extent of, you know, being tuned into it and watching it and doing whatever I can to make people realize the stakes and to play an active role by voting and by, you know, educating themselves about what's going on. And it's interesting this time not being so intimately involved, then I get to see sort of that a lot of what goes on isn't personal. It just happens, you know, no matter who's running. And that's valuable for me, too, to have this other perspective, because for so long I was looking out from the inside, and it's different this time around.
Kristen Gore. Her new novel is called Sammy's Hill. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close by remembering the lyricist Fred Ebb, who died Saturday of a heart attack.
With his longtime musical collaborator, John Kander, Fred Ebb wrote the songs for the shows Cabaret, Chicago, Kiss of the Spider Woman, and Flora the Red Menace, and the songs for the film New York, New York. Here's Fred Ebb singing one of their most famous songs at the 92nd Street Y in New York in 1973. John Kander is at the piano.
Is sitting alone in your room. Come hear the music play. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. Put down the knitting, the book and the broom. Time for a holiday. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. Come taste the wine, come hear the band. Come blow a horn, start celebrating. Right this way, your table's waiting. No use permitting some prophet of doom to wipe every smile away. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. I used to have this girlfriend known as Elsie, with whom I shared four sordid rooms in Chelsea. She wasn't what you'd call a blushing flower. As a matter of fact, she rented by the hour. The day she died, the neighbors came to snicker. Well, that's what comes from too much pills and liquor. But when I saw her laid out like a queen, she was the happiest corpse I'd ever seen. I think of Elsie to this very day. I remember how she turned to me and sang. What good is sitting alone in your room? Come hear the music play. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. And as for me,
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a financial services company serving nearly 3 million members. Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, where values thrive. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, investigative reporter Seymour Hersh. His reporting in The New Yorker broke the story about abuse and torture in Abu Ghraib. His new book is called Chain of Command, The Road from 9/11 to Abu Ghraib. He won a Pulitzer Prize 35 years ago when he broke the story of the My Lai Massacre. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.